Well, namaste. The music that we began with tonight was recorded on 7 February 1954 by the mother. And it is 7 February in Pondicherry. We are in the chapter, the third in Essays on the Gita, which Sri Aurobindo retitled The Human Disciple when it was released as a book in 1923. The first series of the essays alone were issued in 1923. It would be a few years more before the second series would see print. But we've reached that point in this chapter where he is beginning to describe the psychological nature, the experience of Arjuna as he stands on the battlefield, getting ready to undertake warfare. And we might remind ourselves what that scene is. We'll, of course, spend a good deal of time looking at this battlefield in a couple of chapters. But Sri Aurobindo, in this previous paragraph, has noted that Arjuna asked his friend and charioteer to place him between the two armies so that he can view them and look proudly into those whom he will defeat in battle. We should remember that Arjuna has been given divine promise of victory. The question of loss is not before him. But as he steps in front of this scene and he surveys those whom he will be putting to death, along with his brothers and companions in arms, he sees his teachers, his kinsmen, people that he's grown up with, people that he has learned from. And he is horrified at the prospect of war. As Sri Aurobindo says, it's not that he didn't know these things before, but he didn't realize it all. But now it comes to him. Comes to him sensationally, vitally, and hits him in the middle of his being, in his emotional nature. So we pick it up from there. And by the way, the citations that I'll give through this all come from the Bhagavad Gita. I'll just mention the chapter number and the shlokas generally associated with this. Pardon me. The first result is a violent, sensational, and physical crisis which produces a disgust of the action and its material objects and of life itself. He rejects the vital aim pursued by egoistic humanity in its action, happiness and enjoyment. He rejects the vital aim of the kshatriya, victory and rule and power in the government of men. What, after all, is this fight for justice, when reduced to its practical terms, but just this, a fight for the interests of himself, his brothers, and his party, for possession and enjoyment and rule? This is the first chapter, shlokas 32 through 40. But at such a cost, these things are not worth having. For they are of no value in themselves, but only as a means to the right maintenance of social and national life. And it is these very aims that in the person of his kin and his race, he is about to destroy. And then comes the cry of the emotions. These are they for whose sake life and happiness are desired. Our own people. First chapter, Shloka 28. So first the vital aims for the war, and now the emotion, feeling sympathy for those he'll slay. Who would consent to slay these for the sake of all the earth, or even for the kingdom of the three worlds? What pleasure can there be in life? What happiness, what satisfaction in oneself after such a deed? The whole thing is a dreadful sin. For now, the moral sense awakens to justify the revolt of the sensations and the emotions. It is a sin. There is no right nor justice in mutual slaughter. Especially are those who are to be slain the natural objects of reverence and of love, those without whom one would not care to live. And to violate these sacred feelings can be no virtue, can be nothing but a heinous crime. Granted that the offense, the aggression, the first sin, the crimes of greed and selfish passion, which have brought things to such a pass, came from the other side. Yet, armed resistance to wrong under such circumstances would be itself a sin. And crime, worse than theirs, because they are blinded by passion and unconscious of guilt, while on this side, it would be with a clear sense of guilt that the sin would be committed. And for what? For the maintenance of family morality, of the social law and the law of the nation? These are the very standards that will be destroyed by this civil war. The family itself will be brought to the point of annihilation. Corruption of morals and loss of the purity of race will be engendered. The eternal laws of the race and moral law of the family will be destroyed. First chapter, shlokas 38 to 42. Ruin of the race, the collapse of its high traditions, ethical degradation and hell for the authors of such a crime, these are the only practical results possible of this monstrous civil strife. Therefore, cries Arjuna, casting down the divine bow and inexhaustible quiver given to him by the gods for that tremendous hour, it is more for my welfare that the sons of Dhritarashtra, armed, should slay me unarmed and unresisting. I will not fight. First chapter, shloka 46. So we see Arjuna in front of his enemies, with his own troops behind him, sinks vitally, emotionally, and throws down his weapon. Can you imagine the shock of the scene to those all around? Can you imagine the shock to the gods who look down from heavens, trying to enact their will through the humans upon earth? Can you imagine? He is not feeling any of that. He's feeling his own faint. The character of this inner crisis is therefore not the questioning of the thinker. It is not a recoil from the appearances of life and a turning of the eye inward in search of the truth of things, the real meaning of existence, and a solution or an escape from the dark riddle of the world. It is the sensational, emotional, and moral revolt of the man hitherto satisfied with action and its current standards, who finds himself cast by them into a hideous chaos, where they are in violent conflict with each other and with themselves, and there is no moral standing ground left, nothing to lay hold of and walk by, no dharma. Chapter 1, Shloka 40. So not the questioning of the thinker. This is not the sage. This is not the philosopher. This is not the spiritually realized being recognizing that peace is better than war. And let's look at the word dharma. And remember that the Gita opens chapter 1, shloka 1, with dharma kshetra, kurukshetra, on the field of the dharma, on the field of the kurus. What did he say? What happened? Dhritarashtra, the father, the blind father with 100 evil sons, wants to know what's happening. And he must see and hear through the eyes and senses of another to gain it, because he is not simply physically blind, but he is also inwardly and morally blind. But here, he has enough sense to realize this is the very field of dharma. Here, conflict occurs. How do we resolve it? As you'll hear me say endlessly through this, the Mahabharata tells us how to deal with division. What is the nature of the human consciousness and being? How can we live divinely? What must we do is the question Arjuna wants the answer to. But Krishna wants him first to be and then to do. Dharma, Sri Aurobindo's note, means literally that which one lays hold of and which holds things together. The law, the norm, the rule of nature, action, and life. It is the law of being. We'll look at it as we go along through these pages, sometimes from the original way the word was used, sometimes the way that the Buddhists have interpreted it. But let's recognize here and now that it comes, I think, from the same root that we get dharana from. Dhr. D-H-R with a dot under the R. And it means to hold together, to hold tight. When we extend it into the term dharana in meditation, meditation, concentration, that's holding fast to the one image or idea in front of you, the seed of enlightenment is before you. You must grasp it and hold it and not let go. You must hold fast. So is there such a thing to which we can hold in the action of life? Is there such a thing through which the universe coheres, through which our individual stations in life find meaning and perfect expression and a path towards divinity? All this is connoted in what means dharma. It is not simply a code of ethics. When it fails us, it is as a code of ethics. If it calls us to know our nature and to use our nature to rise in being, then it succeeds. It depends on the sincerity of the individual. So, Sri Aurobindo continues, that for the soul of action in the mental being is the worst possible crisis, failure, and overthrow. The revolt itself is the most elemental and simple possible. Sensationally, the elemental feeling of horror, pity, and disgust. Vitally, the loss of attraction and faith in the recognized and familiar objects of action and aims of life. Emotionally, the recoil of the ordinary feelings of social man, affection, reverence, desire of a common happiness and satisfaction, from a stern duty outraging them all. Morally, the elementary sense of sin and hell and rejection of blood-stained enjoyments. Practically, the sense that the standards of action have led to a result which destroys the practical aims of action. But the whole upshot is that all-embracing inner bankruptcy which Arjuna expresses when he says that his whole conscious being, not the thought alone, but heart and vital desires and all, are utterly bewildered and can find nowhere the Dharma, nowhere any valid law of action. This whole section, second chapter, shlokas 5 and 7. For this alone, he takes refuge as a disciple with Krishna. Give me, he practically asks, that which I have lost, a true law, a clear rule of action, a path by which I can again confidently walk. He does not ask for the secret of life or of the world, the meaning and purpose of it all, but for a dharma. He wants a code of conduct. Yet, it is precisely this secret for which he does not ask, or at least so much of the knowledge as is necessary to lead him into a higher life, to which the divine teacher intends to lead this disciple. For he means him to give up all dharmas except the one broad and vast rule of living consciously in the divine and acting from that consciousness, all the way to the end of the Gita, chapter 18, shloka 66. Therefore, after testing the completeness of his revolt from the ordinary standards of conduct, he proceeds to tell him much that has to do with the state of the soul, but nothing of any outward rule of action. He must be equal in soul, abandon the desire of the fruits of work, rise above his intellectual notions of sin and virtue, live and act in yoga with a mind in samadhi, firmly fixed, that is to say, in the divine alone. And here we'll go wandering through chapter 2, shlokas 47 and 48, and through shlokas 54 through 58. Arjuna is not satisfied. He wishes to know how the change to this state will affect the outward action of the man, what result it will have on his speech, his movements, his state, what difference it will make in this acting, living human being. Krishna persists merely in enlarging upon the ideas he has already brought forward on the soul state behind the action, not on the action itself. It is the fixed anchoring of the intelligence in a state of desireless equality, samatha, nishkama, that is the one thing needed. Arjuna breaks out impatiently, for here is no rule of conduct such as he sought, but rather, as it seems to him, the negation of all action. If thou holdest the intelligence to be greater than action, why then dost thou appoint me to an action terrible in its nature? Chapter 3, shlokas 1 and 2. Thou bewilderest my understanding with a mingled word. Speak one thing decisively by which I can attain to what is the best. Bewilderest? Vyamishrena. Mingled? Mohayasi. It is always the pragmatic man who has no value for metaphysical thought or for the inner life, except when they help him to his one demand, a dharma, a law of life in the world, or if need be, of leaving the world. For that too is a decisive action, which he can understand. But to live and act in the world, yet be above it, this is a mingled and confusing word, the sense of which he has no patience to grasp. Again, all of this, 3, 1, 2. The rest of Arjuna's questions and utterances proceed from the same temperament and character. When he is told that once the soul state is assured, there need be no apparent change in the action, he must act always by the law of his nature, even if the act itself seem faulty and deficient compared with that of another law than his own, he is troubled. This is chapter 3, shloka 35. The nature? But what of this sense of sin in the action with which he is preoccupied? Is it not this very nature which drives men, as if by force and even against their better will, into sin and guilt? His practical intelligence is baffled by Krishna's assertion that it was he who in ancient times revealed to Vivasvan this yoga since lost, which he is now again revealing to Arjuna, and by his demand for an explanation, he provokes the famous and oft-quoted statement of avatarhood and its mundane purpose. This is chapter 4, shlokas 1 through 8. He is again perplexed by the words in which Krishna continues to reconcile action and renunciation of action, and asks once again for a decisive statement of that which is the best and highest, not this mingled word. When he realizes fully the nature of the yoga which he is bidden to embrace, his pragmatic nature, accustomed to act from mental will and preference and desire, is appalled by its difficulty, and he asks, what is the end of the soul which attempts and fails, whether it does not lose both this life of human activity and thought and emotion which it has left behind, and the Brahmic consciousness to which it aspires, and falling from both, perish like a dissolving cloud? Well, a couple of references there. Chapters 6, shlokas 33 and 4, and chapter 2, back to chapter 2, shloka 40. So we can see that as we wander along, Arjuna resists easy conversion and remains bound to outward action, seeking a clue to that. When his doubts and perplexities are resolved, and he knows that it is the divine which must be his law, he aims again and always at such clear and decisive knowledge as will guide him practically to this source and this rule of his future action. How is the divine to be distinguished among the various states of being which constitute our ordinary experience? What are the great manifestations of its self-energy in the world in which he can recognize and realize it by meditation? 10:16. May he not see even now the divine cosmic form of that which is actually speaking to him through the veil of the human mind and body? Chapter 11, shlokas 1 through 4. And his last questions demand a clear distinction between renunciation of works and this subtler renunciation he is asked to prefer, the actual difference between Purusha and Prakriti, the field and the knower of the field, so important for the practice of desireless action under the drive of the divine will. And finally, a clear statement of the practical operations and results of the three modes of Prakriti which he is bidden to surmount. Chapter 14, shloka 21, chapter 17, first shloka. So he is dogged in his determination to find the way forward in the outward life. Give me a rule, again and again. And this is indicative of the nature of humanity, that we are gravid. We seem to always fall back to a customary spot that we were familiar with. But Krishna is also persistent and draws Arjuna ever upwards. Arjuna may be silvery and not golden, but Arjuna also means clear and clarifying. And so he can clearly receive the message and do the divine work. Krishna has faith in him. To such a disciple, the teacher of the Gita gives his divine teaching. He seizes him at a moment of his psychological development by egoistic action, when all the mental, moral, emotional values of the ordinary egoistic and social life of man have collapsed in a sudden bankruptcy, and he has to lift him up out of this lower life into a higher consciousness, out of ignorant attachment to action, into that which transcends, yet originates and orders action. Out of ego, into self, out of life and mind, vitality and body, into that higher nature beyond mind, which is the status of the divine. Para Prakriti. He has, at the same time, to give him that for which he asks, and for which he is inspired to seek by the guidance within him. A new law of life and action high above the insufficient rule of the ordinary human existence with its endless conflicts and oppositions, perplexities and illusory certainties. A higher law by which the soul shall be free from this bondage of works and yet powerful to act and conquer in the vast liberty of its divine being. For the action must be performed. The world must fulfill its cycles. And the soul of the human being must not turn back in ignorance from the work it is here to do. The whole course of the teaching of the Gita is determined and directed, even in its widest wheelings, towards the fulfillment of these three objects. The soul fulfilled in the cosmos, aiding and assisting and implementing the divine will, the Sanatana Dharma, endlessly expressing itself in that age and now in this age, in you, in me, in all. That concludes that chapter, and I should say before we wander away from the evening, the next 2 weeks will be the 13th and the 20th of February, and as our custom, we're going to take these next two Sundays and look at the book, The Mother. Next Sunday, we will rapidly summarize and move through chapters 1 through 5, and then on the 20th, which will be actually the 21st in Pondicherry by the time we meet, we'll look at chapter 6. So something we do each time, and we enjoy it, and we hope you will as well. So we will be getting to the core of the teaching shortly. Be patient. The essays seem to be long, but we'll be in very deep water, and happily so, soon. Tonight, let's conclude with a reading from Savitri. Since we're in February already, Book 3, The Book of the Divine Mother, and this is the opening of Canto 1. Oh, I should cite the page number. This is on page 305. Canto 1, The Pursuit of the Unknowable. All is too little that the world can give. Its power and knowledge are the gifts of time, and cannot fill the spirit's sacred thirst. Although of one these forms of greatness are, and by its breath of grace our lives abide, although more near to us than nearness self, it is some utter truth of what we are. Hidden by its own works, it seemed far off, impenetrable, occult, voiceless, obscure. The presence was lost by which all things have charm, the glory lacked of which they are dim signs. The world lived on, made empty of its cause, like love when the beloved's face is gone. The labor to know seemed a vain strife of mind. All knowledge ended in the unknowable. The effort to rule seemed a vain pride of will. A trivial achievement scorned by time, all power retired into the omnipotent. A cave of darkness guards the eternal light. A silence settled on his striving heart. Absolved from the voices of the world's desire, he turned to the ineffable's timeless call. A being intimate and unnameable, a wide, compelling ecstasy and peace, felt in himself and all and yet ungrasped, approached and faded from his soul's pursuit, as if forever luring him beyond. Near it retreated, far it called him still. Nothing could satisfy but its delight. Its absence left the greatest actions dull. Its presence made the smallest seem divine. When it was there, the heart's abyss was filled. But when the uplifting deity withdrew, existence lost its aim in the inane. The order of the immemorial planes, the godlike fullness of the instruments, were turned to props for an impermanent scene. But who that mightiness was, he knew not yet. Impalpable, yet filling all that is, it made and blotted out a million worlds, and took and lost a thousand shapes and names. It wore the guise of an indiscernible vast, or was a subtle kernel in the soul. A distant greatness left it huge and dim, a mystic closeness shut it sweetly in. It seemed sometimes a figment or a robe, and seemed sometimes his own colossal shade. A giant doubt overshadowed his advance. Across a neutral, all-supporting void, whose blankness nursed his lone immortal spirit, allured towards some recondite supreme, aided, coerced by enigmatic powers, aspiring and half-sinking and upborne, invincibly he ascended without pause. Always a signless, vague immensity brooded, without approach, beyond response, condemning finite things to nothingness, fronting him with the incommensurable. Then, to the ascent, there came a mighty term. A height was reached where nothing made could live, a line where every hope and search must cease, neared some intolerant, bare reality, a zero formed, pregnant with boundless change. On a dizzy verge where all disguises fail, and human mind must abdicate in light or die like a moth in the naked blaze of truth, he stood compelled to a tremendous choice. all he had been, and all towards which he grew, must now be left behind, or else transform into a self of that which has no name. Alone, and fronting an intangible force which offered nothing to the grasp of thought, his spirit faced the adventure of the inane. Abandoned by the worlds of form, he strove. A fruitful worldwide ignorance foundered here. Thought's long, far-circling journey touched its close, and ineffective paused the actor will. The symbol modes of being helped no more. The structures nescience builds, collapsing failed. And even the spirit that holds the universe fainted in luminous insufficiency. In an abysmal lapse of all things built, transcending every perishable support and joining at last its mighty origin, the separate self must melt or be reborn into a truth beyond the mind's appeal. All glory of outline, sweetness of harmony, rejected like a grace of trivial notes, expunged from being silence, nude, austere, died into a fine and blissful nothingness. The demiurges lost their names and forms. The great schemed worlds that they had planned and wrought passed, taken, and abolished one by one. The universe removed its colored veil, and at the unimaginable end of the huge riddle of created things appeared the far-seen Godhead of the whole, his feet firm-based on life's stupendous wings, omnipotent, a lonely seer of time, inward, inscrutable with diamond gaze. Attracted by the unfathomable regard, the unsolved slow cycles to their fount returned, to rise again from that invisible sea. Namaste, Jai Ma.